Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 10th of September 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Well, I will just start by reminding listeners that I am wanting to hear from you, the Radio Albion listeners, as an accusation has been made against me that what I say is likely to stir up hate. So I would like to hear from our listeners how Radio Albion makes you feel, why you listen, and especially if you have been inspired to take any action at all. Particularly good is if you have been listening since the Radio Aryan days and can comment on any changes you may have noticed over the years. And if you could do that for me and just send a short description of how Radio Albion makes you feel to stormersubs@hushmail.com, or you can send it to me via Gab or in the Discus comments, in the chat room, on Telegram, or in any of the ways that you have to contact me, I would be very, very grateful for that, and it could prove to be very useful to me. Right, getting into the show today, this is episode 12 in our series on patriotic history, and we are going to be getting into ancient Egypt today, and of course, I am joined by my co-host once again, the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Patriarch, good day, sir. How are you doing? Are you still on holiday?
Very well, thanks. I'm not on holiday, actually. I'm just I'm in out of the country though, but I'm still working. We're just visiting the wife's family. So, yeah, although the sun is out, I'm not technically on holiday. But yeah, we're here. It's all good.
Not technically, but in enjoying yourself whilst exploring another country. All the same, must have been a nice summer for you anyway.
Yeah, I definitely did spend some time exploring parts of the country, but it's really mostly been with family and just staying in their houses and whatnot, and just, I guess, exploring and experiencing their way of life. So yeah, it's nice to experience.
Always good to broaden your horizons and your understanding of how other people live. And that's what we're concerned with, really, in this podcast here, is looking at the birth of civilization and the connections that it has to white people and what we can learn from looking back at it today. And ancient Egypt is probably the most famous and the most looked at of all the ancient civilizations, and there is so much that we're going to get into in this. It's probably going to take 5 or 6 episodes to do in all. We will also be looking at the connection with Joseph from the Bible and also with Moses from the Bible, but that will come later on. We'll also be looking at the Great Pyramid, but just to start off with a description of what ancient Egypt was, it was a civilization of ancient North Africa. So even though it is to the east of the large continent that we see of Africa, it's still considered to be a part of Africa, but North Africa. And that's very important to stress, North Africa, because North Africa was white in antiquity. It was south of the Sahara that you had the Negro types, and in North Africa you had the Caucasian types. And ancient Egypt was concentrated along the lower reaches of the Nile River, and situated in the place that is now called the country Egypt. Ancient Egypt civilization followed prehistoric Egypt and coalesced around 3100 BC, according to conventional Egyptian chronology, with the political unification of Upper and Lower Egypt under a character called Menes, often identified with the pharaoh Nama, and also identified by L.A. Waddell as actually being the same person as King Minos of Crete. And similar to what we learned with the Indus Valley civilization, the ancient Egyptians that formed this civilization, they didn't grow out of the people that were there before. And we know this because suddenly civilization just bursts forth, and there's no gradual build up to it. There's no gradual learning of how to write and metallurgy and how to make sanitation systems. It just suddenly all appears in 3100 BC. So this implies that a new type of man appeared in the area and brought the civilization with him. And of course, we identified 3000 BC as being roughly the time of the flood in Mesopotamia. There's this great flood that there is evidence for, and the oldest texts that we have say that that wiped out the people that were there before, or there were some left behind, but it wiped out the pre-civilization thing that they had, and then a new one began. Kingship was lowered in around about 3000 BC, and the city that was centered on was Cush, and we tie that in with Noah's son, who was called Cush, Noah's grandson that was actually called Cush, and Cush, his brother, was called Mizraim, and Mizraim was the father of the Egyptians. So we can see that all of this sort of happened around about the time that the Bible tells us, and it's borne out by the archaeology when we see this flood that took place in Mesopotamia. And this king Menes, he basically unified upper and lower Egypt, and it became one united kingdom in the same way that Israel and Judah became a united kingdom, and England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland today are a united kingdom. Do you want to comment on any of that, Patriarch?
I guess my initial question would be, with them being united, would this south southern part being closer to in Africa, would that have been what led to the mixing?
There wasn't really any mixing until much later on, because you had a caste system. I mean, that happened in about 1,000 years' time after this. We'll get into all the multicultural side of it. I think what they likely had at this time is you had a new type of man that actually came in to the area, and he probably made use of the people that were already there as servants, labourers, builders. And I think that's the way that it would have been. And I think that we would have had a caste system, the same as the Indian stuff tells us that they had a caste system, the Hindu caste system. And we know that the ancient Nordics had a caste system. It was the way that things were. And we read in the Bible they had a caste system as well. The priests, the Levites, you had to show that you had actually been a Levite priest for 10 generations to actually be one. It was all about inheritance. It wasn't about where you were born. It was about who your fathers were and who your father's fathers were, and that determined what caste you actually were. So it was almost like a eugenic system. If you had somebody that had a group with a very high IQ, that they would keep that high IQ unless they interbred with other types with a lower IQ. And as we've learned before, the Hittites did they did pawn off their princesses, basically, particularly to the Egyptian pharaohs. And the Hittites themselves tried to civilize the other peoples that were around. And they, once they had civilized them, then they interbred with them. And that was the cause of the downfall of many empires, basically. But at this point in time, we didn't have that, I don't think.
Yeah, there's a lot of significant marriages that took place, isn't there, throughout the ages? I mean, from King Solomon and his pharaoh princess to even Caesar of Rome. So it seems to be quite popular to have a pharaoh princess, doesn't it?
Well, that was the downfall of Solomon, really, was the fact that he had all these wives. But the only legitimate lineage actually came from Solomon and his Hebrew wife. And the offspring of the other wives, although they probably were upper class, they weren't considered as part of the heritage of Solomon. That the same as Judah himself, he also had, I think he had a Canaanite wife as well, and his sons by the Canaanite wife, two of them died, and the one that didn't was called Shelah, and Shelah did not have the royal inheritance. The royal inheritance went to Phares and Zerah, who were through his Hebrew wife. And the Shelahites, although they were alongside the Israelites, they had no role in anything. They didn't have any part in the inheritance because they were illegitimate, basically. So the same thing would have happened here with the pharaohs.
Yeah, the Bible tends to do that, doesn't it? The chosen line is always what is followed in terms of genealogy, and the same goes for Cain and Abel. In respect to Cain's line wasn't included as part of Adam's line, and then we follow Adam's line through Seth, which literally means replacement. So I just wanted to make a point of how the Bible's consistent in how it determines, you know, the actual authentic lines as opposed to the inauthentic ones.
And we also have consanguineous marriage amongst the pharaohs originally. They would marry very close to themselves in the same way that Adam was married to Eve, and the same way that Abraham was married to his half-sister Sarah. Back then, you could have this very close marriage, and it wouldn't result in genetic defects. And the same thing happened with the pharaohs originally. Although they would also take these other wives that were then part of a treaty with another people. They would give you a wife to take, and then you would make peace with that people. And that really sort of continued on into Europe. Which is why our royal families are all intertwined with the others. Like, if you think the Tsar was related, the Russian Tsar that was killed, he was related to the British King, and our recent Duke who died, he was a Prince of Denmark and also a Prince of Greece. So through this dynastic intermarriage, it was supposed to help keep the peace. And although today it was just done between European types, back then, as I said, you also had Arabic types and non-white types that were also being taken as wives, which is really setting a very, very bad example for the people, and led to the downfall of these civilizations, as we've shown. But getting back to Menes, who is credited with starting the Egyptian civilization. The Egyptians in this area before then were likely not white, as like with the other civilizations we have looked at, there was no gradual evolution of the arts of civilization. It just suddenly appears with the arrival of Menes, who is seen as the founding figure for much of the history of ancient Egypt, in a similar way to Romulus, who was seen like that by ancient Rome. Diodorus Siculus states that Menes introduced the worship of the gods and the practice of sacrifice, as well as a more elegant and luxurious style of living. And for this latter invention, Menes' memory was actually dishonoured by the 24th dynasty pharaoh Tefnacht, and Plutarch mentions a pillar at Thebes on which was inscribed an imprecation against Menes as being the introducer of luxury. Because, of course, we know today when you have too much luxurious living, it results in weak men. So by the time of the 24th dynasty, they were lamenting the fact that they had this luxury because it had weakened the Egyptians, and they had been taken over by foreigners. And they pointed to this luxurious living as being the reason for that. And I find it interesting that Diodorus Siculus states that Menes introduced the worship of the gods, but also the practice of sacrifice. And the practice of sacrifice was that a sacrifice for sin? Was that showing an origination with the sacrifices that the sons of Noah made? Because straight away after the flood, we're told that they made a sacrifice, and we read throughout the Bible that sacrifice to God played a role in the early Adamites. So is that a hint here as well that this was, you know, he was somehow descended from these Adamites? Because I do think Menes bears quite a resemblance to Mizraim, doesn't it? You know, it has the same three letters in it, really. M, N, S. Mizraim has M and S, and instead of an N, it has an M, but it's still very close, isn't it?
Yeah, it could be possible. I mean, it's hard to say exactly, you know, how and where sacrifices started. Because I know a lot of even tribal nations, even in the Aztecs and whatnot, they were big on sacrifices, you know, live sacrifices. But so it's hard to pinpoint that as being something specific to the line of Adam. But yeah, it's one to think about.
I think it depends on what the sacrifice is for. If the sacrifice is to appease the gods, like a human sacrifice, then that wouldn't have been from God. But if the sacrifice was for sin, in the way that the Levites sacrificed, in the way that the Druids sacrificed, then that would have been from God. So
yeah, atonement biblically is you know what's required for the death is required for sin. It says the wages of sin is death, right? So you know, the animals were was a substitute essentially, and that's where you ultimately get the Lamb of God from, which is in Christ.
So atonement rather than appeasement. So we would have to look at into this more to find out what well, the sacrifices were for. Well, Diodorus Siculus also recorded a story of Menes related by the priests of the crocodile god Sobek at Crocodilopolis, in which the pharaoh Menes was attacked by his own dogs while out hunting, and he fled across Lake Moeris on the back of a crocodile, and in thanks he founded the city of Crocodilopolis. And this brings to mind the images of St. Michael standing on the dragon. And I'm thinking perhaps this was the earliest instance that we actually have of this imagery, would have been of Menes stood on this crocodile. And of course, today we still have this same imagery with St. Michael with the dragon there. And you can pretty much see it working its way through time. There's always been images of somebody with a spear on a dragon or spearing a snake. I mean, it's a very common image to actually see. And this may have been the original image of it was this Menes. And again, I mean, I guess it's a similar word to Michael Menes. It starts with the same letter. Anyway, it could well have changed over time. I mean, this is also tied in with St. George and the Green Man. And we might get into that as well, actually. And the fact that Osiris was green, because we also see St. George spearing the dragon as well. So there may be a tie in with that. That's something that we'll look at later on. And also it was something to do with the crocodile that was actually the anointing oil that they used, and that's where the word Messiah actually comes from, is Mesek, which is something to do with the anointing oil that they actually made from a crocodile, and that's where the word Messiah actually came from. So this crocodile was, there was more to it than them just worshipping animal-type gods, basically. We don't really understand what their idea of the gods was back then. It was different to our idea of it today. George Stanley Faber in 1816, taking the word campsa to mean either crocodile or ark, and preferring the latter, identified Menes with Noah and the entire story as a flood myth. So Menes could be an Egyptian version of the biblical father of Egypt, Mizraim, who is one of the sons of Noah. And that could have been tied in with them talking about this campsa, and actually that meaning an ark, because that's also what the word can mean, as well as actually crocodile. So again, we've got another connection to Noah there, basically.
Interesting.
According to Manetho, Menes reigned for 62 years and was then killed by a hippopotamus, whereas L.A. Waddell claims that there is evidence that he actually travelled to Ireland, and he died from a wasp sting, from an allergic reaction to a wasp sting. So and how he gets to that is, there is a story in Egyptian history of somebody going to traveling to the west through the sea, and L.A. Waddell identifies the place that he travels to as Ireland, and through the way that L.A. Waddell translated the hieroglyphs and the Sumerian writing, he said that this character was actually the same person as Menes, because they did have different titles for them. I guess we still have different titles for them today. I mean, Elizabeth Battenberg, Windsor, you know, they have lots of different names, and His Royal Highness or Her Royal Highness, and they had the same back then. So that's how he gets this idea that Menes also travelled to Britain, and he also identifies Menes as being Minos of Crete, who we were talking about in the last episode. This history of ancient Egypt then follows as a series of stable kingdoms separated by periods of relative instability known as intermediate periods. We have the Old Kingdom of the Early Bronze Age, the Middle Kingdom of the Middle Bronze Age, and the New Kingdom of the Late Bronze Age. And we'll look at each one of these ages and the important things that happened in them. Egypt reached the pinnacle of its power in the New Kingdom, ruling much of Nubia and a sizable portion of the Near East, after which it entered a period of slow decline. During the course of its history, Egypt was invaded or conquered by a number of foreign powers, including the Hyksos, which we will look at in detail because there were two different invasions of the Hyksos, and each different invasion was actually a different people, although they were referred to as just the Hyksos by the Egyptians, meaning foreigners. They were also invaded and conquered by the Libyans, and the Libyans back then were white. The Nubians were black, or a portion of them were. The Assyrians, the Achaemenid Persians, and the Achaemenid Persians, actually, they were Shemites, and the Achaemenid kings were Shemites. That's why Cyrus allowed the Judahites to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple, because he was part of the same ethnicity as these Judahites. So they ended up ruling for a while as the Achaemenid Persians. And then finally the Macedonians under the command of Alexander the Great. And we'll also be looking at what happened there. The Greek Ptolemaic kingdom, formed in the aftermath of Alexander's death, ruled Egypt until 30 BC, when under Cleopatra it fell to the Roman Empire and became a Roman province. And if you want to learn about that, I do recommend reading Flavius Josephus' Wars of the Judeans, which goes into a lot of detail of what was happening in the Roman Empire at the time. It's actually a fantastic book. It's probably my one of my favorite books, is reading the collected works of Josephus. It took me a year to read it entirely, and I've read them twice now, and they are just incredible for an idea of how we used to live and the things that we used to hold as being valuable, and the morality of what our people used to be like, and the Romans, the sense of honor that they had. It's really illuminating to read. And also it has a lot of extra information that goes along with the Old Testament as well. And when you're reading it, don't think this is written by a modern Jew, like the modern Jews today. It was written by a white man. He tells the reader of his ancestry, and his reason for telling of his ancestry is to show that he has noble ancestry. Basically, he comes from a pure Hebrew line. So he was a white man, and he wasn't the same as these modern Jews who trace their heritage through to a different group. And it's actually in Flavius Josephus' work that he talks about how the Judahites ended up being interbred with these Edomites, who were the offspring of Canaanites, basically, and how the only group that actually rejected that were the Essenes. And the Pharisees and the Sadducees went along with this interbreeding, but the actual Judahites themselves were not happy about it, and they were constantly going on about how Herod was born of ignoble birth, and he shouldn't be the king. And of course, once Herod was the king, he replaced all the priests, and he replaced the high priest, and he replaced the Pharisees, and he put all his men into these top positions. And that was the world that that Christ came into. And that was the political setup that was in Judea at the time. But I cannot recommend reading Flavius Josephus' work enough.
I think that's one of the sticking points for a lot of, pagans. People would rather gravitate to, I think today a lot of nationalists are kind of looking to retain some sense of identity. And because they look back and see that the Jews of today, who aren't necessarily the original people, they're the face of Christianity, they kind of instantly turned off. When if people actually realized that there was a more of a distinct reason why Jesus rejected and opposed the Pharisees and most of the Jews in that area, was really because they were Edomites. And we know that as well because he talked about proselytes and foreign converts. I mean, he really used some harsh language towards them. I think one of the scriptures was that he accused them of traveling land and sea to make one proselyte, and by doing so, you make them a child of hell like yourself. And these are the kind of scriptures that most Judeo-Christians would just gloss over and think nothing of. But when you kind of scratch the surface and look a bit deeper into the lineage of these people and what was going on, then it kind of falls into place as to why Christ was so opposed to them and how they were basically polluting the core message and the religion, really.
Yeah, they were called proselytes of the gate and proselytes of justice. And basically anybody could become a proselyte of the gate or a proselyte of justice, and then they could become a Judean citizen, and then they were known as Jews. And you had a lot of vagabonds and ruffians from all around the area that actually came into Judea and became Jews, and they essentially had an equivalent of the Bolshevik Revolution against the Romans. Which is why the Romans ended up going to war against them. And when the temple was actually burning, and it was the Jews that set fire to the temple, the Roman soldiers had tears in their eyes at seeing such an ancient work of art being destroyed. And the Jews just, they couldn't care less. You know, they just wanted to destroy and create chaos. And Flavius Josephus tells us that they were dressing up in women's clothing. They were doing horrific things. There was all this famine going on, and they just went completely crazy. And it reminds me of what happened with the Bolsheviks, and of course that was all foretold. And you're right, it did it polluted the message, because the message throughout the Old Testament is of an exclusive people, a priestly people, and the promises are made to that specific people. And it talks about the faith of Abraham, and Abraham's faith was that many nations would come from his loins. Not that many nations would claim he was their father, but that many nations would come from his loins. And those nations were known as the Gentiles. So when you see all these prophecies and all this talk of the Gentiles in the New Testament, what it means is the nations, and it means the specific nations that were promised to Abraham.
Yeah, and I guess these Egyptians, before they were fully integrated and mixed, I guess would come under that, the nations being descended from Ham's line, right?
Well, they came from the previous dispensation, which was to Adam, the promise that was made to Adam, and the promise that was made to Noah. And the Egyptians, or that came from Mizraim, they came under those first two covenants, the one that was with Adam and the one that was with Noah. And then it becomes narrowed down to Abraham, and then Isaac, and then Israel. And then it says in the Bible that all these other nations will eventually, they'll be lost, which is what happened to all the nations of antiquity. And there will just be the nations of Israel, which are left. And being a follower of Christian identity myself, then I identify those nations as being the European nations. They're the ones that are left behind. And that's the reason why we became Christian, because it's the same people throughout history. And our ancestors were, these are our white ancestors that we're talking about now that were in these civilizations. And they ended up being lost to time, basically through going back on God's law of kind after kind and not taking strange wives, and that caused the downfall of these civilizations, and that caused the downfall of Egypt. But at the time that we're talking about here, Egypt had yet to fall. Their ethnicity was still pure, basically, and we know this because When we get to the story of Joseph, we see that Joseph is welcomed by the Pharaoh, and he's given a wife by the Pharaoh, and he saves Egypt from famine, and he also wins back all these lands that have been taken by the Hittites and by these other tribes, and he wins them back for Pharaoh. But then by the time we get to the time of Moses, the Pharaoh knew not Moses, and the reason why he knew not Moses is because that he was no longer an Adamite. It was one of these Hyksos groups, which was the Canaanites, basically, again. But we'll get to all of that in detail, but just to concentrate for now on the actual race of the Egyptians that we were talking about at this particular period. The Egyptians came from Mizraim, the brother of Cush, the son of Ham, the son of Noah, and they were thus a white people, because all the sons of Noah were white. They can only have been white. You couldn't have a white brother and a Chinese brother and an African brother all from two parents. You could only, if the two parents were white, the offspring can only have been white. The evidence is overwhelming that these first Egyptian societies were white, a proto-Nordic Alpine Mediterranean mixture. Of course, it's since then that we've had these classifications of Nordic and Alpine, and back then, although they were still white, we don't know exactly what type they were, but we do know that when we do these DNA tests on these old bodies, the closest they are to anybody alive today is to Europeans, which is, as we learnt with in Sumeria, in Crete, and also in the Indus River Valley, and it's the same here in Egypt. The leadership elite, in particular the pharaohs themselves, were mostly Nordic. The mummified remains of numerous pharaohs and common folk from this first great Egyptian civilization all have unmistakably white features. For example, the well-preserved body of Pharaoh Ramses II has red hair, and there are large numbers of mummies whose blonde hair has been extraordinarily well-preserved through the centuries. A well-preserved body found in a sand grave in Egypt, dating from approximately 3300 BC, on display in the British Museum in London, was actually nicknamed Ginger because of his red hair, a racial trait only found in persons of Nordic ancestry. The tradition of Nordic pharaohs was to last almost until the second part of the Third Kingdom, circa 1050 BC, by which time racial demographic shifts had taken place in Egyptian society that were in favour of non-white groups. It was during the Old Kingdom period that the Great Pyramids and the Sphinx at Giza were built, starting around the year 2500 BC. The project was launched by Pharaoh Cheops, also known as Khufu, who, because of the pyramids, remains one of the most famous pharaohs of this first kingdom. And his daughter, Queen Hetepheres II of the 4th dynasty, is shown in a coloured bas-relief in a tomb to have been a distinct blonde. Her hair is painted a bright yellow, stippled with little red horizontal lines, and her skin is white. And that's we have a citation there from The Races of Europe, Carlton Stevens Kuhn, New York City, Macmillan, 1939. And that's from page 98. And the evidence for them being white is just copious amounts of this evidence. You can look up the actual pictures on the mummies. You can look up the DNA tests that have been done on them. And really, you just have to look at the standard of civilization that they had. It's the same standard of civilization that we have today. So there's a lot of evidence to show that they were white, basically.
Yeah, I had a debate with this leftist girl once, and she was claiming this guy was claiming that about the ancient Israelites were, sorry, not the ancient Israelites, the Egyptians were black, and I kind of made a comment and obviously showed some of the pictures and that, and which was the guy we just mentioned, the mummy with the red hair,
Ramses the Second.
Yeah. I mean, he's clearly Caucasoid for a start, and she was making out that his hair was ginger because of the bleach and the kind of the chemical compounds over time turned it ginger. So that was one point she was making to claim against it. I don't know if you've got any counterpoint to that.
Yeah, they used to claim that as the excuse, but they have since then found that no, it was actually ginger. That's not right. The case. It wasn't the mummification process that turned it ginger. And there are other mummies. There's Yuya, the vizier. You can see that he's clearly Caucasian. You can see the representations that they actually drew of themselves and of their gods, and it shows that they have Caucasian proportions. You know, we have different, as white people, we have different proportions to our arms, our legs, our trunk, the angle of the face, of the skull. We have different proportions. I mean, when you look at the god Osiris, he's green, yet he still has the proportions of a white man. which shows that the people that actually created that imagery, they were white themselves, even though the skin color of the deity is actually green. And you can see that with all of their gods. But there were times when Egypt was controlled by non-whites, and there are representations of them, and it tells us in history about them having these wars with them, and how they got taken over by the Nubians. So this did happen, but we also have evidence of racial segregation. The Egyptians, there's one famous picture, and it shows four different races. I forget the exact four different races they are. I think there's Nubian there, there's Semitic, there's Egyptian, and there's one other there. And you can see that there's quite clearly there are differences between them. There was also a sign that was put up on the barrier between Egypt and Nubia, and it was saying that if any black Nubian trespasses or comes past this barrier, they will be executed. They are not allowed past this barrier, basically. And there's also images on Tutankhamun's sandals, and on one sandal he has the sub-Saharan Negro type, and on the other sandal, on the sole of the other sandal, he has what we call a Semitic type, which is basically the Canaanite type. Because all the representations that the Canaanites did of themselves were of that particular type, with the same distinctive nose that we associate with Jews today. That nose was associated with the Canaanites back then. So King Tutankhamun was actually walking on these two images of these two particular races, because they were seen as enemies to the Egyptians. And that was the symbolism of having them on the soles of his sandals, so that he was walking on them. And there are other images of battle images of holding heads and enslaving black people. But then there are other images of the white people being enslaved by the blacks as well. So there were these battles. And the actual period, I think, when the Nubians defeated the Egyptians and they took power, that really didn't last that long. And then by the time you get to about the time of Christ, we have images from mosaics which show that the Egyptians were distinctly mixed by that time. They had the features that we would describe as mulatto features today by that time.
Distinctly mixed race.
Yeah. And also because you had a large number of mixed race types, I mean, that weakened the integrity of the nation, and it meant that it could be taken over by these other peoples that were making war against them. Because Egypt became a multicultural empire, you know, that weakens the empire once it becomes multicultural, especially if you allow interbreeding between the different types. It's gonna weaken the empire.
Well, it severs the roots, doesn't it? It severs the roots to your ancestors and history, essentially. And I think that's what's happening here in the West, you know, and the globalists know that, you know, in terms of wanting to create a new world, do away with the old world by essentially cutting them at the roots. So there's no kind of, reason to cling on to the past, to what your ancestors fought for, because it's diluted instantly. You know, half of you is one way and half of you is another way. So it's like straight away, you're not kind of definitively representing a particular part of history.
Well, you're not going to lay down your lies for an idea, are you? You're going to lay down your lies for your people, for your family, for your ancestors, if you've been cut off from that and you've just got... Mm-hmm. Some general idea of being a part of an empire, you're not going to lay down your life for it. I mean, we've just seen that happen in Afghanistan. We've seen the triumph of ethnicity and religion over liberal democracy and the values of liberal democracy. You know, the Afghan army that were supposedly united by wanting to promote these values of liberal democracy, and the people they were up against, the Taliban, they were united by their shared ethnicity and their shared religion. And against the entire might of the Western world and all the military technology that America has, the mountain men in their sandals were able to defeat them. And it's because they had this shared sense of ethnicity. And, you know, you can see that going on back then in Egypt. So once they no longer had this shared ethnicity and they just had the idea of, well, we're part of this Egyptian empire, you're not going to want to lay down your life to save the empire. You're just going to want to do whatever is best for you on an individual basis. So it does weaken people to cut them off from their ancestry. And of course, there's the theory about a Kudinov-Kalogi plan, which Kudinov-Kalogi put into his book Practical Idealismus, and he's seen as the father of the European Union. And his plan was to do just that, to import racial types that were far different from the European racial type and have them interbreed with the European racial type to create a new type that was similar to the type that we see in Egypt today, which is a mixed-race Arab type, and then to have them ruled over by an elite that were of a different racial type. And that was his plan. And then, bizarrely enough, what we see the European Union doing today is importing these racial types that are very different to ours, and we see this encouragement for us to interbreed with them all the time on the television. Every advert you see will have a black man with a white woman, and we'll see all these television programs that feature the same. Constantly we've been bombarded with imagery and advertising to encourage the interbreeding between the races, which will result in offspring that don't have an ancestry and don't have a connection to any particular nation, so that they will be defined by what they purchase. They'll be defined by materialism. They'll be defined by what music they like or what football team they support, rather than having a solid identity in who they actually are and who their ancestors were. Because if you have, when you have that identity, that's something strong that you can coalesce around. Blood is thicker than water. So our rulers today, they don't want that. They don't want resistance or any resistance they want. They want it to be as weak as they can possibly make it. And the best way to do that is to take away people's identity, which is why we are concerned with identity here and reinforcing identity and talking about our history and our ancestry to give people a sense of hope and to give them something solid that they can coalesce around. So they don't feel on their own and cut off from everyone. You know, we have this extended family here of white people of European heritage, and that's what we're concerned with here. And I don't think they really properly understood this back then. They understood that they had a nation, a white nation, but they didn't really understand that the other nations around them were part of their extended family. I mean, the Assyrians were going to war against the Egyptians, going to war against the Hebrews. And it was the same with us right up until last century. I mean, we were going to war against the Germans, and we had all these petty jingoistic squabbles between ourselves. So we're really no better than, you know, these empires in antiquity that were fighting against one another. We're really no better today. I mean, as nationalists or as ethnocentrics, we might think that we've learnt from our mistakes of the past, and as nationalists we extend the hand of friendship to all other nationalists, really. I mean, Radio Albion in particular has listeners from all over the white world. It's not just British and American listeners. We have you know, Bulgarian listeners, Swedish listeners, Swiss listeners, German listeners. And in the past, that would really have been seen as not something that would happen, because, you know, the English were against the Germans and the Germans were against the French. But now that we're all facing the same sorts of problems, we're all facing the loss of our identity. We're all facing an increase in numbers of people of different ethnicity to us. We sort of have a shared threat that we're all facing. So that helps to unite us. And the threat itself has been caused by ourselves. It's been caused by us going back on our traditions and going back on our religion and going back on what our ancestors say. I mean, we can't say that this is down to these other peoples. We invited them to come into our countries. Our representatives invited them here. It's not like they got together and said, let's invade Europe. We said, you're welcome to come in. Come. We sent out search parties for them, pretty much. Tony Blair sent out search parties to encourage other ethnicities to come to Britain, and told them all the great things that they would have here when they got here. So we can't blame these other people's sort of situation. We can really only blame ourselves. And once you do that and you take responsibility for it, then you can take action to improve things, which is what we're doing here.
Yeah, it's true. It's a sad case, really. But I mean, obviously, it doesn't help with the empty promises and whatnot. I think, especially just after the war and all the lies that were peddled, and false hopes and misconstrued truths. You know, it kind of. I think you mentioned it in another podcast though, which is definitely true. Our strengths were used against us in some ways and turned into a weakness in terms of our general empathy for people. And you know, you think something's temporary, and then what was said, you know, generations ago is kind of it's just added to, lies are added to, and before you know it, it's you're kind of head above water.
We have to be on our guard. You know, we have to understand that we are competing against the other races and the other ethnicities. That's the way the world is. We have limited territory. We have limited resources. And it is a competition. And these other groups, they understand that. And they do what is best for their group. And we seem to have a deficiency, which really began in earnest in the last century, where we stopped understanding that, and we just started seeing everybody as being the same, and we forgot that there was this competition going on, and that's why we're failing at it at the moment. But these other groups are succeeding at it. But there really is nothing new under the sun. I think this series is really showing this, that the same problems were occurring in these other civilizations, and particularly with Egypt. When we get to it, when we look at multicultural Egypt, we will really see that there is no difference with what's going on today to what was happening to Egypt. And getting back to early Egypt here, the early dynastic period was approximately contemporary to the early Sumerian Akkadian civilization of Mesopotamia and of ancient Elam. And Elam is where the earliest library was. We talked about that in the first and the second episode. The Sumerian civilization was the civilization of Kush, and then the Akkadian one was when Sargon of Akkad came in and took over Mesopotamia. And we can also add to this the Indus River Valley civilization. That was all contemporary to this Egyptian one, and the one in Crete. And they were really all linked up together because they were all trading with one another. And L.A. Waddell says that they were all franchises of this original one that was really started in Cappadocia. I mean, it's all in this same area in the Near East. The 3rd century BC Egyptian priest Manetho grouped the long line of kings from Menes to his own time into 30 dynasties, which is a system that is still used today. So when you hear about the 29th dynasty or the third dynasty, that's where it all comes from. It comes from this priest Manetho. He began his official history with a king named Meni, or Menes in Greek, who was believed to have united the two kingdoms of Upper and Lower Egypt. Major advances in architecture, art, and technology were made during the Old Kingdom, fueled by the increased agricultural productivity and resulting population, made possible by a well-developed central administration. Some of ancient Egypt's crowning achievements, the Giza pyramids and the Great Sphinx, were constructed during the Old Kingdom around 2600 BC. Under the direction of the vizier, state officials collected taxes, coordinated irrigation projects to improve crop yield, drafted peasants to work on construction projects, and established a justice system to maintain peace and order. And I suspect that the peasants that were drafted would have been the non-white type that came from Sumeria, the type that was talked about in those ancient tablets about how the Sumerian gods mixed one type with another with in vitro fertilization to create the black-headed people. And I think they would have been the people that they used for these building projects. And as we'll hear, the Giza pyramids and the Great Sphinx, the directors of those building projects were a different type. They were another white type. the Egyptians and Menes and the people that started all this out, they were one particular type of white man. But the guys that actually came in to build the pyramids and the Great Sphinx, they were a different type, which we'll hear more about next week. We'll start with a little look at the Great Pyramid now. The Great Pyramid of Giza, also known as the Pyramid of Khufu or the Pyramid of Cheops, is the oldest and the largest of the pyramids in the Giza Pyramid Complex, bordering present-day Giza in Greater Cairo, Egypt. It is the oldest of the seven wonders of the ancient world, and it is the only one to remain largely intact. So you think that was 4,500 years old. It's about the same time that Stonehenge was being built in Britain. Stonehenge is actually built using the same unit of measurement that the Great Pyramid is built to. Egyptologists conclude that the pyramid was built as a tomb for the 4th dynasty Egyptian pharaoh Khufu, and they estimate that it was built in the 26th century BC and that it took around 27 years to build. But they've never actually found a body within it. I mean, they say that it was built as a tomb, but it was never actually used as a tomb. Bit strange to put 27 years into building one of these greatest wonders of the world and then not to actually use it, if that's what it was actually intended for. Initially standing at 481 feet tall, the Great Pyramid was the tallest man-made structure in the world for more than 3,800 years. Throughout history, the majority of the smooth white limestone casing was removed, which lowered the pyramid's height to the present 454 feet. What is seen today is the underlying core structure. The base was measured to be about 230 metres square, giving a volume of roughly 2.6 million cubic metres, or 92 million cubic feet, which includes an internal hillock. And the blocks that it's made from are all about 2.5 tons, and this white limestone casing that it was covered in, it was incredibly thin, and they used this incredible glue to actually glue it to the stones, which they cannot actually replicate today, and bits of it could break off and it would still stick there. A tiny speck of it would still stick there, and the glue itself was micromillimeters thin, an incredible substance it was that actually glued this white limestone to it. And because it was covered in this white limestone, it would reflect light out, and they reckon that if you were on the moon, you would have been able to see the Great Pyramid because of the sun's reflection of this light. And it also worked as a giant sundial, and you could not only tell what the time of day was, but you could also tell exactly what time of year it was. And the place that it was actually put is really important as well, because it's right in the middle of the Earth's landmass, and the actual measurements of the pyramid encoded within it is the size of the Earth, the weight of the Earth, the distance between the Earth and the Sun, the number of days that there actually are in a year. Pi is encoded in it, the golden ratio, the golden mean, phi, that is also encoded within it. And right at the top, the cornerstone, the top stone, is missing. And of course, throughout the Bible, there's all this reference to the cornerstone and Christ being the cornerstone. And what that is referring to is this capstone, this cornerstone that is actually missing from the pyramid. So later on, we have all the hieroglyphics, and we have all the temples and all the information that we can get from those hieroglyphics. And what we have here with the pyramid, instead of having hieroglyphics, instead of having carved sculptures, what you have is mathematics and geometry that is encoded into the actual building itself, the size of it, the angles of it, the passages on the inside, and the ratio between all of that is how you get to these mathematical numbers. And a lot of these numbers, like the distance between the Earth and the Sun and the weight of the Earth and things like this, we didn't even know ourselves until the last century. And yet somehow 4,500 years ago, the architect of the Great Pyramid encoded all of that into this building. And it's quite incredible when you think about it. And there are lots of books about it. I've got
We'll have to give some examples next week because I'm kind of intrigued myself to, you know, needing to get my head around exactly how they could be interpreted and not necessarily misinterpreted as being just something that we're bringing our own meaning to. Because obviously you naturally be quite skeptical at first, thinking, okay, I wonder how, is it something, are we bringing our meaning to it, or was it legitimately kind of prophetic? So I don't know, it'd be nice to get some case samples just for the listeners and for our own understanding to know what we're talking about.
Well, the geometry that's involved in it, I mean, that's unarguable. The ratio that there is between the angles and the size of it, that's where you get all these figures from. The prophecy side to it, that's another side to it as well, where when you work out the actual pyramid inch itself is worked out to be, I haven't got the exact number here in front of me, but it's something like 90 millionths of the circumference of the Earth is the pyramid inch that was actually used for building the pyramid to. That was the scale that it was built to. So somehow they knew what the circumference of the Earth was and to make that the inch. And it's very close to the inch that we have today as well. And they also knew perfect north. It was built to perfect north. It wasn't built to magnetic north. We'll get into all of this next week, but what we're going to use
I look forward to that.
We're going to use E. Raymond Capps' book, A Study in Pyramidology, and he basically went through all the early pyramidologists and collected all their work together. And I've also got a shorter version of it, which is The Great Pyramid Decoded, again by E. Raymond Capps. But the problem is, I'm not going to be able to put that into the notes, which is a bit unfortunate. So people will have to listen to the podcast, and if they're just looking at the notes, they won't realise that the next episode is going to have all this information on it. But nothing about aliens or mummies coming to life. It's basically just about the geometry of the pyramid. It's just beyond me how anybody could have known that back then. And it couldn't just be by coincidence, because there are so many different measurements that are encoded into it and so many different ratios. You could say that the prophecy side of it, which is basically that the tunnels that are actually in there have got markings on them, and people say that those markings were if you have 1 inch corresponds to 1 year, wherever these markings are, they mark important events in world history going from the time that the pyramid was built. I guess you could say, well, that could correspond just by coincidence, because there could be lots of different important things happening on that particular day, or, you know, every day of the year something important happens. So you could say that was just projection, but the actual geometry and the mathematics that is encoded in the pyramid, I think that would have been impossible to do just by chance. Absolutely impossible, because this was built to a plan. You know, the guy actually had a plan when this was built, and they even dug these four great sockets into the stone at each corner to allow it to move, which is something that we don't actually see in architecture until much later. But he knew about ball and socket joints, basically, so that this giant structure could move. And you think all the amount of stone that was put into building that. We weren't able to build anything higher than that, or anything like that height, for another 4,500 years. It's just, what technology did they use to do it? I mean, as I said last week, I mean, it may have been that there was less gravity around at the time.
Well, there was one interesting theory that I watched, and it was quite interesting, and it did seem somewhat plausible. I don't know if we've got time to discuss it now, have we, or leave it for next week. Are we okay?
Yeah, how long is it? Just give a brief overview of the theory.
Well, basically, if you imagine how a 3D printer works, the foundation was set, and they would pour in almost like kind of tubes of that would get the concrete to be poured in, and then they would lay over the top these casts, and then they would pour in the concrete and cement, and brick by brick, they'd move to the next one, pour it in, recast, and then they would essentially work their way around layer by layer, brick by brick, like a 3D printer almost. And then obviously with the tunnels, they would factor that in as they went along. It was interesting. I sent you a link anyway to give it a watch.
That discounts the fact that they have the quarries for this, and I think they actually diverted the Nile to bring the blocks down through the river, and they've got the road there that they built for actually bringing these blocks of stone actually to the pyramid. So it was taken from this quarry. It can't have been done on site, or at least the ancients that tell us about this, because there are records of this being built. We'll go into the people that actually built it as well. Okay. But they have records of it and how it was done. So what you're talking about there is probably someone saying, well, it could have been done this way. But there was evidence.
Yeah, it's sort of theorized for sure.
I think I've seen that.
It kind of offers a more palatable understanding of how something of such great stature could be built, instead of, you know, these large megalithic rocks being placed brick by brick.
There's a dolmen in Ireland, and it has a capstone that is 100 tons. 100 tons. How did people manage to lift that up onto the uprights 4,000 years ago? The mind boggles. Anyway, yeah, we're going to have to leave it there, I think, Patriarch. So thank you very much for coming on today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more patriotic history for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.